At the end of this lecture, you realize that we will achieve, you know, there will be a, like, if you, at some point in the lecture, there will be like a sound that's like zoom, and then we'll just all know cosmology. Anyway, I have a special announcement for the half of you that were not here this morning, that I am with you guys. I have never made it to a 9 o'clock lecture that I was not giving. So I just don't want you to feel bad. I just want to say though that you missed like the best by far one. You really missed out on the good one. I will say one thing, which is that there was one important point that I wanted to get across in Wednesday's lecture, and which I just completely flubbed, but which is one of the most important points in the class. So just to say it one more time, there are three puzzles at the homogeneous level that inflation is supposed to solve. You should understand them as follows. You should understand them all in a unified way as follows. Let's imagine the universe is a three-sphere, just for example, and it expands. At any given moment in time, it is characterized by two length scales. One is the size of the sphere, the size of the spatial unit, the radius of curvature of the universe. And the other is, so that measures the instantaneous size, but the other is a length scale set by the expansion rate. So h, the expansion rate at that moment, to the minus 1 power, is another length scale. The ratio of those two length scales, this over this, 1 over ah, that is the co-moving Hubble distance. That is the so-called co-moving Hubble radius. And so at any given moment, if we cover the board with co-moving observers who just sit at these positions on the board, as the universe expands, in this co-moving picture, what happens is that this co-moving radius grows and shrinks. So around any given observer, there's a co-moving sphere at a given time with this radius, and it can shrink or grow with time. Now, the whole problem with all of the three puzzles with cosmology that are supposed to be explained by inflation, the horizon problem, monopole, and flatness, those all boil down to the fact that in the absence of inflation, if the universe was always decelerating ever since the Big Bang, if A double dot was always less than zero, then two things are true. First of all, this co-moving Hubble radius has always been expanding with time to include more and more co-moving observers around the central one. And secondly, that at any given time in such a universe, the size of the co-moving Hubble horizon surrounding a given observer is also essentially the size of that observer's past horizon. So if at a given moment, this is the co-moving Hubble sphere surrounding that observer, he has not been able to receive signals since the Big Bang from anyone outside that sphere. So all the puzzles boil down to those two facts. And the resolution of the puzzle from inflation is just to break those two facts. You say, okay, if instead, prior to radiation domination, the universe had a period of acceleration, then during that period, the co-moving Hubble volume was shrinking. The relationship between the size of the co-moving Hubble volume and the actual physical past horizon is completely broken. And all three puzzles are solved if you just require the following simple geometric fact, that if this was the size of the co-moving Hubble volume at the beginning of inflation, and then what happened is, according to inflation, during inflation, that shrunk by a huge factor, so it shrunk down to some tiny little sphere whose radius is smaller than the original one by a factor of e to the minus n. So during inflation, the co-moving Hubble volume shrunk to a tiny little sphere around the observer. And then ever since inflation, it's been re-expanding. But if, so it's re-expanded, and this is the co-moving Hubble sphere today. If the co-moving Hubble sphere today is contained within the co-moving Hubble sphere at the beginning of inflation, all those puzzles are solved. So the condition is that the number of e-folds of inflation, n here, has to be enough that the original shrinking factor is bigger than the subsequent growing factor. Okay? So that, yeah.
Yeah, how, like, with the current model, how long should we wait for until our Hubble sphere spend?
That's totally unknown. Totally, it's a totally open question. Yeah. It's not known. I mean, yeah. It's a good question though. But it's different models say different things. Different people say different things. There's no observational evidence one way or the other. Okay. That's all I'm going to say now. In the previous lecture, I had been introducing perturbations, and the main thing that I want to do in this lecture is outline. So the second problem on your problem set is just going to be to go through the calculation from the starting point that we're about to say to the end point, which are famous formulae. So the end result that we want to derive are formulae for the primordial power spectrum of scalar perturbations zeta and tensor perturbations hij. So these are the things that we have all, these are the perturbations whose spectrum we have already observed in detail in the cosmic microwave background and whose growth is responsible for galaxies and clusters today. These started off, so inflation produced a spectrum of tiny little fluctuations of order 10 to the minus 5 in the early universe in these guys, and then as the universe went along, they grew and grew and grew until they grew into something really interesting. But anyway, you can measure the properties that these had in the very early universe in great detail, and now inflation is supposed to reproduce those properties. So we're going to compute the spectrum of those. And then I'm not going to go through, I go through in parallel in the notes the calculation of the corresponding primordial tensor spectrum, or in other words, the primordial gravitational wave spectrum. That's the other type of perturbation that is predicted by inflation. These have not been measured yet. It is hoped that these will be measured in the next, well, it depends on, it depends a little bit, but hopefully in the next few years, maybe in the next decade, also possibly not in the next decade, depending on how things go. But so there is the hope of measuring these, whereas these guys are primarily measured by measuring the fluctuations, the difference in temperature of the cosmic microwave background at different points on the sky. The tensor perturbations are primarily measured by measuring the difference in the polarization pattern of the cosmic microwave background across the sky. Anyway, if these guys were measured, that would be a real, that's something to watch out for. That would, most people would say that is the one observation you could make that would come the closest to clinching the case that inflation really did take place in the early universe. Okay. So the starting point we said, which is something that I stress you're not supposed to derive on the problem set. Even though it's not hard, and I give a reference if you want to look at this section of this paper by Maldacena, if you want to know how to derive it, that's great. He shows how to do it in a way that's not hard. But it's too hard for the problem set. So we're just going to start by saying that if we start the action for single scalar field, for single field inflation, which is the paradigm we're working in, we said it's the action for, it's our old friend, the action for gravity, and then minus the action for a single scalar, or, you know, plus the action for matter, and the only matter in this model is just a single scalar field that dominates the universe. All other matter fields, like in the standard model of particle physics, are assumed to be negligible at this early epoch. Okay, so then Maldacena will explain to you the following points, that you choose a gauge. You can choose a gauge. You can make a tiny little coordinate transformation so that, okay, even if your scalar field was initially perturbed, so it had an unperturbed part that only depended on time, but then now we've allowed it to have a little perturbation, delta phi of t and x. So it's a little part that actually depends on space, which is the first time we've allowed anything to depend on space in this class. You can make a little coordinate transformation to set this thing to zero. So that's one gauge choice. And then g mu nu, we can write the metric, we can write the line element as in the so-called ADM form. Which I think those of you who were taking Renata's class and maybe also Ruth's class, I'm not sure. encountered this form for this way of writing down general relativity. But so the bottom line is that in this, for our purposes, the important thing to say about this is that you've divided space-time into spatial slices and time. Hij here is nothing but the metric, the three metric on the spatial slice at time t. And ni, the so-called shift vector, and n, the so-called lapse function, are not physical degrees of freedom. They are fixed by the constraint equations in Einstein's equations. They have to do with how you choose your an unphysical choice for how you choose to thread your time coordinate and slice your spatial surfaces through the space-time. And then the bottom line was that Maldacena will continue explaining to you that you can write this matrix Hij, which I made the same mistake last class. Let me call this gamma ij because I want to call something else Hij. Gamma ij is the ordinary scale factor times e to the 2 rho, this is the scalar perturbation, so that's not a matrix, times e to the 2 h, that is a matrix. So that gamma is a 3 by 3 matrix. It's equal to a function of time, a function of space and time, times a matrix, which is a function of space and time, times the unit matrix. Or, of course, you can, you know, this is, So these are the meanings. These are the meanings of rho and h. H satisfies these extra conditions. These are all gauge conditions that we had the freedom to specify by making little coordinate transformations. That the trace of h is equal to the divergence of h. It's equal to zero. So h, the tensor, the matrix representing the tensor, the gravitational wave perturbation, is, like all good gravitational waves, traceless and transverse. If you haven't met that fact about gravitational waves, you'll meet it in a general relativity course at some point. But so that's all. I'm just trying to give enough of a glimpse to get across the point that these are the two small quantities. Their meanings have to do with, so if it was a pure FRW universe, you would just have this. These things would both be zero, and so these factors would both be one. But the scalar perturbation amounts in this gauge to saying that the scale factor may have a space-dependent rescaling at different points in space, because this thing, unlike this scale factor, the ordinary Robertson-Walker scale factor, this one can depend a little bit on space. And then this guy can also depend a little bit on space, but it doesn't rescale the overall volume at a given point. It does anisotropic rescalings. These traceless transverse rescalings are sort of, you know, it might take the volume here that was previously isotropic and squeeze it a little bit in this direction and expand it a little bit in this direction in such a way that it doesn't change the overall volume. It just distorts the space-time locally. And the bottom line is that if you just plug this perturbation in this gauge into this action and expand to second order in these small perturbations rho and h, you find that h becomes a zeroth order part that we don't care about, a first order part that vanishes, plus s sub zeta, a part that's quadratic in zeta, plus s sub h, a part that's quadratic in h, plus higher order terms that are also too small to ever observe, at least in single field inflation, probably. Okay, so we care about these bits, and these bits are really easy. So there are equations 16a and 16b in the notes. By the way, the new notes, I put up new copy of lecture note 7, which is way better than the copy from earlier this morning, so in case you didn't update. I'm just going to do the calculation for, I'm just going to sketch the calculation, which you're going to do in more detail in the problem set. But I just want to get across some of the basic ideas of how you do quantum field theory in curved space-time. Okay. So, Z is a function that it just appears in this derivation when you're expanding. When you're expanding this action to second order, again, see Maldacena for more details, but here I'm just quoting the answer. You expand to second order, and the only thing that depends on zeta at second order is this term. And since it's totally decoupled from the tensor perturbation term, we can just consider them one at a time. So I'll just forget for the rest of the lecture about the tensor perturbations. So Z is this function, which is, it's approximately, and this is another thing that so the exact thing that it is, the exact expression is it's A squared times the conformal time derivative of phi, of the background phi, this is the unperturbed phi, over the conformal time derivative of A. So this function is not dependent on space. This is just like the scale factor represents the unperturbed part of the metric. It's a function only of conformal time eta. Z is only a function of conformal time eta. It's almost like another scale factor, a scale factor that this zeta variable, it's kind of the zeta perturbation. You can almost say physically it doesn't so much feel the ordinary scale factor, but because its action has this form, it feels this scale factor. This is the scale factor that it feels in the sense that it couples to. Okay, so if this thing was constant, this would just be the action. The remaining thing here, this is just the Minkowski metric. The remaining thing here is the action for a free massless scalar field in Minkowski space. Okay, this is the kinetic term for an ordinary scalar field in Minkowski space. The only difference is the only thing we need to do is just understand how to generalize what you did in one of the first, in probably in one of your first lectures. Did you guys ever do canonical quantization, or did you just do purely path integral? You did canonical. So when you canonically quantize this field, we're just going to do exactly the same thing. The only thing is that because it's occurring in a gravitational background, in an expanding background, there's this time-dependent function z that appears in the action, and that makes all the difference. That makes the difference between not producing any perturbations and producing a primordial spectrum of perturbations. Okay, but other than that, the calculation is really You'll see. It's really very akin to what you do when you canonically quantize. So let me just sketch that. So remember how quantum mechanics works. You give me the action for some variables. You give me some Lagrangian, some action which is ddt of a Lagrangian, which depends on some variables and their time derivatives, and maybe explicitly on time, but in our case, there's no explicit dependence on time or space. So, and then from that, so Dirac taught us the general procedure for how you go to quantum mechanics given a classical system like this. How do you quantize it? You first define the momentum pi conjugate to qi. So that momentum is dl dqi dot, the partial derivative of this Lagrangian with respect to the qi dot, wherever it appears. And then you declare that now q and p are not just classical variables in phase space, they are operators. And they don't commute with one another. They now obey the so-called canonical commutation relations, which are that all of the q's, so they now become operators, so they have hats on them. All of the q's commute with all of the other q's. All of the p's commute with all the other p's. These are commutators of these operators. But the q's don't commute with their respective p's. So, and then quantum field theory in the original, you know, version due to Dirac is in the canonical quantization prescription, what you do is you just say, okay, well, all quantum field theory is now I have a scalar field phi or whatever, I have a scalar field zeta, and it used to be a variable. It used to be like an infinite number of these q's. There was a q, but instead of being a discrete number of q's for every value of this index I, there's now an infinite number. There's a q at every point in space and time. So that's fine. So I just take the continuum limit, the appropriate continuum limit of all of these things, and so for each phi, I compute its conjugate for phi of x and t. I compute its conjugate momentum, the analog of the continuum analog of p sub I here. So its continuum analog is partial phi at x and t, partial t. And then I declare. So in this case, for example. So in this case, stop calling it phi. Let's call it zeta because that's what we're doing. So my variable, the analog of q here is zeta, which is a function of x and t. And then the conjugate momentum to that is pi of x and t, which is d Lagrangian d zeta dot, which is z squared, sorry, and because my time coordinate is going to be the conformal time in this calculation, let me switch to eta. So it is z squared of eta times zeta prime of x and t, or that's a d prime means dd eta again. As usual. And now I'm going to impose the continuum analog of these canonical commutation relations. So I'll say the zeta at any point in any time commutes with zeta at any point in any other time. Well, let's just usually it's enough to impose the commutation relations at a given time. So different positions x, but a given time. These so-called equal time commutation relations. So But zeta does not commute with pi, or at least not when they're coincident in space. So, in other words, at least not the analog of delta ij there will become a delta function of x, spatial x vector minus spatial x prime vector. So in other words, okay, and it's very possible that I'm going to make some minor errors in numerical and factors here, but they're correct in the notes. So fine. So we have this variable zeta. We know what its conjugate momentum is. We promote those two things to operators satisfying these canonical commutation relations. So now, the next thing we want to do is we want to Fourier transform just with respect to space. Okay, we're going to Fourier transform in the spatial directions, not in the time directions. And in particular, when we Fourier transform in space, we could Fourier transform with respect to the physical spatial coordinate or with respect to the co-moving spatial coordinate. And you... believe me when I tell you, you want to Fourier transform with respect to the co-moving spatial coordinate. You could do it the other way, and you would just be making your life harder. But you should do it this way. So, So the basic idea now is that if I Fourier transform, so let me first define the Fourier transform of the classical field. So before I quantized anything, I just separated the field into Fourier modes, spatial Fourier modes in the usual way. IK vector dot x. Okay, so since I've only Fourier transformed with respect to the spatial coordinate, I still the Fourier coefficient still depends on time, right? So now I promote this thing. When I promote this, because zeta is a real field, you can check if you take the complex conjugate of both sides of this expression. But zeta is a real number, so its complex conjugate is equal to itself. Whereas over here, we get the complex conjugate of this guy and the complex conjugate of this guy, demanding that the expression and its complex conjugate be equal to one another ends up saying that zeta sub k is equal to zeta complex conjugate of minus k at any given time. Okay, so the zeta, the amplitude zeta sub k is really not independent of the amplitude zeta sub minus k. And so when we promote these now to when we promote this thing to an operator, so we promote this thing and this thing to an operator, the classical condition that this was a real field becomes the condition that this is a Hermitian field, that it's equal to at every point in space and time. This operator is equal to its dagger, and so the analogous condition on this thing becomes that the operator corresponding to the kth Fourier mode is equal to the dagger of the operator corresponding to the minus kth Fourier mode, and you can convince yourself that that means that if you want to rewrite these things as a purely So this is an operator. It depends on time. Okay. So zeta sub k is an operator that depends on conformal time eta. We want to split it into an operator that does not depend on conformal time eta, times just a function that does depend on conformal time eta. Okay. When you do that, this condition. Another thing that you should convince yourself on the homework is that demands that when you do the Okay, so I want to split zeta sub k, the operator, into zeta sub k, the function, the eta dependent function, times a hat sub k, the eta independent operator. But because of this condition, I can write that splitting this way. Okay? And so now the point, the next point, which probably you were kind of asked to do this sort of problem already on a quantum field theory, either in class or on a quantum field theory problem set. But so in any case, this is very close to something that you probably have seen or done in the early days of a quantum field theory course, in the early days of your quantum field theory course, is to say, okay, if the operator zeta, so we can now that we have the operator zeta written this way, we can just take the d d eta derivative to get the operator pi, right? We just take the dd eta derivative here. So we take dd eta over here. So the only thing dd eta acts on over here is this thing. This has the only eta dependence. But then this thing is this. And so the dd eta acts on this function and this function and doesn't talk to the eta independent operator, right? Okay, so when we take that derivative, we now have an expression for zeta in terms of these so far unspecified functions times a and a dagger, and for pi, also expressed in terms of these the time derivatives of these functions and a. So now, if you ask what commutation relation must the a and a daggers satisfy in order for the zetas and pis to satisfy this commutation relation, the answer is they have to satisfy the ordinary commutation relations for creation and annihilation operators. So in particular, the A operator for any Fourier mode K vector commutes with the A operator for any other Fourier mode K prime. And similarly, the A daggers commute with the A daggers, but the A's do not commute with the A daggers. So the commutator of A with A dagger is something like, I probably am dropping some factor. Maybe there's an h-bar in front here. I'm actually not even sure that's, well, in any case, if we set h-bar equal to 1, then I can't be screwing that up. But anyway, again, the thing that is correct is in the notes. Okay, so in other words, if there was no k index, if you just forget about the fact that we're doing field theory and just zoom down to one degree of freedom, if zeta was just q and pi was just its corresponding p, then the a and a daggers would be the creation and annihilation operators that you meet when you learn about the harmonic oscillator and quantum mechanics. And that is not a coincidence. That happens because the harmonic oscillator is the case in quantum mechanics where the potential is just a quadratic function. So it's 1/2 m squared, 1/2 m omega squared q squared. And the action that we're dealing with is just a quadratic function of the field variables, which is why what we have is some generalization. We end up with some generalization of the creation and annihilation operators with one creation and annihilation operator for every Fourier mode K vector. Yikes! There's no next lecture to spill over to. Okay, sorry. So we're almost there. So these guys satisfy the classical equations of motion. Just like in ordinary quantum field theory, what you put in for the mode functions here, if you want these things to satisfy the Heisenberg equations of motion, which in this case just reduced to the classical equations of motion, that the classical equation of motion for zeta, since these things are time and space independent, that just reduces in this case to the statement that these zeta sub k's, these things that are functions, not operators, just satisfy the classical equations of motion. Okay, which in this case, you can derive the classical equations of motion from that action, and it's so it looks like this. And so notice that this looks extremely similar. This equation, this is the sort of equation that every differential equation you encounter in cosmology has this basic form, okay? much of cosmology can be done with linear differential equations, second-order differential equations like this one. So remember that when we dealt with non-thermal relics, or when we dealt with a homogeneous scalar field, when we talked about non-thermal relics in an earlier lecture and in the tutorial, and also when for the early birds that were here this morning, we dealt with them this morning also. So they have an equation of motion like phi double prime, double dot plus 3h phi dot plus m squared. And so this is 3a dot over a. M squared phi is equal to 0. OK, so they're very analogous equations. They're both the equations of motion for a particle. If we focus on this one for fixed k, they're the equation of motion for a particle. This is the acceleration. It's being acted on by a frictional force. I say that because this is the velocity of the particle, phi dot, and this is the velocity of this particle, phi zeta prime. And then this is the restoring force of the harmonic oscillator. In this case, it's m squared phi. In this case, it's k squared zeta. But so in either case, m or k is playing the role of omega, the frequency of the harmonic oscillator. So just as we had a transition between two types of behavior here, where you could either be in the regime where this term, this friction term, was small, and the field, the particle underwent basically harmonic oscillations with frequency m, with a slight damping due to this friction term, or you could be in the opposite regime when the friction term was very important, and then what happens is that the field, that the particle rapidly relaxes to its terminal velocity, where it's hardly accelerating. So this term is negligible, this term is negligible. And these two terms, the friction term just perfectly balances the forcing term. The friction term just perfectly balances the forcing term. So the same story, the same sort of logic that we used for dealing with homogeneous scalar fields, we can use to very quickly calculate the power spectrum for perturbations as follows. So imagine a particular co-moving wavelength of perturbation. So across space, zeta is fluctuating. This local perturbation of the scale factor that we're ultimately interested in, that we're ultimately going to measure through the temperature fluctuations of the CMB, is fluctuating. And we're working in co-moving coordinates, and we've Fourier decomposed in co-moving coordinates. So this wavelength, the wave itself may grow and decay with time, but the wavelength is just going to sit there. It's a co-moving. We've defined the wavelength in co-moving coordinates. So the wavelength sits there. Okay, it's some fixed size, but then during inflation, what happens is that the idea of inflation is that the co-moving Hubble radius shrinks, and then re-expands. So initially, the co-moving Hubble radius is huge relative to the wavelength of interest. And you say, quote unquote, that mode is inside the horizon initially. Okay? That's the extremely confusing terminology that you will hear people say. And then as the Hubble horizon shrinks, there's a moment where it crosses the co-moving wavelength of interest. At that moment, you say, quote unquote, that mode left the horizon. Then the horizon, the Hubble radius continues to shrink, gets tiny, inflation ends, the Hubble radius starts to grow again. At some point in the late universe, maybe even recently, the co-moving Hubble radius, as it's re-expanding, once again crosses the wavelength of that co-moving, and you say, quote unquote, the mode re-entered the horizon. And then it continues to expand. Once it re-enters the horizon, that's a perturbation that is short enough that you can observe it today. It's short enough that by pointing two telescopes at sufficiently widely separated in the sky, you can see the trough, one trough of that wave in one direction on the sky and another trough in another direction on the sky, for example, if it's the CMB. And once it's much, much shorter, once the co-moving Hubble horizon has gotten, if this particular mode is much shorter than the co-moving wavelength, then you don't have to see successive waves and troughs. You don't have to point your telescope at two widely separated points at all. A wave and trough will be so much smaller than the Hubble horizon that they'll be right next to each other. They'll be right next to each other on the sky. They won't span a huge angle on the sky. Okay, so. What we're going to do to calculate the spectrum is the following. Now that we know these commutation relations for A and A dagger, we can take, we define the vacuum to be the state that is annihilated, just like in the harmonic oscillator, the vacuum is annihilated by the annihilation operator, A, and in is the starting point in quantum field theory is you define this Fock space where the vacuum is, you can create particles of momentum k by acting on the vacuum with, you can create n particles of momentum k by acting on the vacuum with n copies of the creation operator, A dagger sub k. But the vacuum is defined as the state that is equal to zero when you act on it with an annihilation operator A, any annihilation operator. So for any k, you operate on the vacuum, and it's equal to zero. That condition is the definition of the vacuum. With that definition, you can compute. We can take our operator expression. We've expanded zeta. We've expanded the operator zeta like so, which is like so. And then this thing, we expanded in terms of creation and annihilation operators. So you can square that thing and sandwich it between the vacuum. You can take the vacuum expectation value of zeta squared at time x and conformal time eta. And that thing, you will find, if you just plug in those expressions, you will find that's equal to, okay, if you plug in those expressions and you make use of the fact that because the universe is isotropic, because these perturbations are living on an isotropic background, so because the equation of motion for these zetas does not depend on the direction of k, it only depends on the magnitude of k. Here, k squared, I just mean k spatial vector squared. So you, again, it's one of these things where you could do it. You don't have to do this, but you would only make your life harder. What you should do is choose these functions, zeta and zeta star. Choose your solutions to only depend on the magnitude of k. Okay, so I say that merely because at the end of the day, so whenever you have integrals, you can convert d cubed k times a spherically symmetric integrand into the integral from 0 to infinity of 4 pi k squared dk. Okay, so you get 4 pi k squared dk times some stuff by just plugging in, and then you rewrite that as the integral from 0 to infinity of dk over k times some other stuff And then that you rewrite as the integral from minus infinity to infinity of d log k times this exact same stuff. I'm just saying rewrite dk over k as d log k. So the limits of integration, if they were 0 to infinity for k, they're minus infinity to infinity for log k. So then you define the power spectrum of zeta. The power spectrum of zeta is defined to be, so at wave number k and time eta, is just defined to be dd log k of this. Dd log k of this vacuum expectation value of zeta squared. And so that is nothing, but if you look at this expression, that's nothing but whatever is in whatever this is. And so what is that? You will find that it's, well, I actually could get this wrong, but I think it's k cubed over 2 pi squared times the absolute value of zeta sub k, this zeta sub k, the plain old function, the classical complex number solution of this equation. So this thing is not an operator. Okay. So now, I intuit that even though you will find this calculation not hard on the problem set, that I am beginning to mystify you at this point, or beginning to lose a significant fraction of the audience, which is why you're doing it on the problem set. But so just take my word. You have just ground through with these very simple calculations. You'll see there's nothing hard in what we've done so far. Although I'm sure it seems unfamiliar to most of you. So you get this expression. Okay, this thing is the key. We're almost there. Don't rebel. I have this thing where I have like nightmares where you all come after me and beat me with erasers. That's what the jokes are all about. They're just keeping those nightmares at bay. That was supposed to be a joke, but okay. Final step. We're going to do this. I am going to finish this calculation on time. So on time that I'm just going to relax and just celebrate until I run out of. Okay. We want to take this expression and write it in a more physical form. So the way we do that is, so this thing is some solution of this equation. And we said we're focusing on our co-moving wavelength, and we can expect, and you can think about on the homework why this is the right thing. That so the co-moving Hubble horizon started out here in that regime when that was the case, that corresponds to the situation where this term is not very important. And the field is potential dominated. It's dominated by this driving force. So when the Hubble horizon is initially out here, this wavelength, so the wavelength stays fixed. It's the co-moving wavelength, but the amplitude is just oscillating up and down with frequency k. Okay. So the solution in that regime you figure out in the same way that we figured out the solution in the underdamped regime here. Remember, we found out that it was proportional to a to the minus. What we did is we did this trick where we changed variables from phi to a to the minus 3, a to the minus 3 halves times v. When we plugged that expression in here, we got a new equation for v, which had no friction term in it. right? And from that, we learned that when the friction term was small, the solution for phi was something like a to the minus 3/2 times cosine mt. So similarly here, if we want to do the same trick, what we should do is we should replace zeta sub k by z to the minus 1 v sub k, and then we get an equation of motion for v, which has no friction term, and from that we learn that in this initial regime, at the beginning of inflation, when the mode is far inside the horizon, the Hubble horizon is big, that zeta sub k goes like 1 over v, 1 over z, times some linear combination of a constant, so some constant times e to the minus I k tau, plus another constant times e to the plus I k tau. Okay, that's the general solution. But depending on what constants you take here, those correspond to choosing, in curved spacetime, those correspond to choosing physically inequivalent vacua. And the standard choice, the choice that looks like what you choose, so what you will find is that what you show in the notes in the problem set is that a sub k1 squared minus a sub k2 squared has to be equal to 1. That's for consistency of the two of the original canonical commutation relations for zeta and pi, for those to be consistent with the canonical commutation relations for a and a dagger. Okay, but you have some freedom still to choose what a and a1 and a2 are subject to this restriction. The standard choice is to choose ak1 is equal to 1 and ak2 is equal to 0. That is the standard choice because physically, something that you should think about why this is true on the problem set. I mean, this is so that, yeah, the whole problem on the problem, there's one like little problem at the beginning of the problem set, and then the whole rest of the problem set is just to go through the notes and understand the derivation. But so, one thing is just that in the far past, when this mode was tiny, where did my mode go? Oh, yeah. When this mode was tiny relative to the Hubble horizon, you're tiny relative to the Hubble horizon, too. And that's why you think you live in Minkowski space. You're so tiny relative to the Hubble horizon that if it weren't for Hubble, you wouldn't even know there was a Hubble horizon. You just think you're living on Earth in Minkowski space. And so, similarly, this mode in the far past, when the Hubble horizon was gigantic relative to it, it was oscillating really fast relative with frequency k, which was huge relative to the time scale over which the Hubble horizon was changing. So it should, what you should choose for these mode functions is the same thing you choose in Minkowski space quantum field theory. And so in the far past, you want to choose something that looks like e to the I omega t plus I k vector dot x vector. That's what in your quantum field theory class, that's the expression that you put in front of your A operator. And so that corresponds to choosing A equals 1 and A2 equals 0. So in other words, different choices correspond, it turns out, in curved spacetime to physically inequivalent vacua, and you're choosing the vacuum that is natural to an observer in the far past. Okay, that's kind of the idea of inflation. That's what people mean when they say the universe started in its vacuum at the beginning of inflation, or something like this. The fluctuation started in their vacuum. Okay, so putting these things together, a sub k, I'm gonna put in that condition now. So, and if I had done things correctly, there would be another factor of square root 2k. Okay, so that's what the evolution equation looked like when the Hubble horizon was huge relative to the mode of interest. And then it shrank, 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 shrank. And then at the moment when it shrinks past and becomes, the Hubble horizon becomes smaller than the mode of interest, i.e. at the moment when the mode exits the horizon, suddenly, very rapidly, the friction term becomes very important. And the field was oscillating, oscillating, oscillating. According to this, it was oscillating with an amplitude that was getting bigger and bigger because Z, it turns out, was decreasing. Nope, that's not right. What did I do wrong here? Is Z in the numerator? Did I put Z in the wrong place? Oh well, oh well. I'm confused about this at the moment, but you will be unconfused when you go through it at the... The notes are correct. That's the one thing I stand by. My God, the notes are correct. I'm confused on the board. But so zeta is... So this wavelength is, according to this expression, just varying up and down, oscillating, oscillating, with some amplitude that is changing with time. And then at the moment that the Hubble horizon shrinks to smaller than its wavelength, friction takes over and pow, it just gets stuck at whatever amplitude it was at. So the typical amplitude, it was varying with time like this, but then suddenly when it exited the horizon, it froze at whatever moment it exited the horizon. Let's call that moment eta equals eta star. So I just, everywhere where there's time dependence here, so in Z and also here, where, I apologize, by tau here, I meant the conformal time. Again, it's another, just one of those other things that's wrong on the board and right in the notes. So, if I now plug that into this expression, and then after it leaves the horizon, that's just it. It's just stuck. It's a constant, and it just stays constant as long as it's outside the horizon, until roughly today, the particular mode that you observe in the CMB came back into the horizon. Since it's just, or maybe it's even, or some of them, even the larger scale ones, are still, Well, that. Let me just say it this way. This thing becomes a constant, this constant value outside the horizon. So if you plug it in here, you find that this thing becomes a constant value. It becomes a constant value given by P sub zeta is equal to 1 over 2 epsilon h over m Planck squared, roughly. So let me just say this. In the cosmic microwave background, a story that I don't have time to tell you here, you observe this number. We saw this thing became time independent because this thing became time independent, but it's still k dependent. And you can observe as a function of k the power spectrum of zeta. And when you do, when you observe the power spectrum at a given wave number k, in other words, at a given co-moving wave, this is roughly speaking like the correlation between two points on the CMB that are separated by a distance, by a co-moving scale, lambda over 2 pi k. The amplitude of the correlation at those scales, the power on those scales, is given according to single field inflation by this formula. It's telling you about what the value of epsilon was, the slow roll parameter epsilon was, and what the value of h was at the moment that co-moving wavelength left the horizon during inflation. So you're doing an observation today, but according to inflation, it's telling you about this ultra early moment before the radiation-dominated era even began. Ultra high energies when modes were leaving the horizon. This is the closing point. For those of you who are going to go on and take the Explorations in Cosmology course taught by Andrew Tully and Sarah Shandera. If you want to learn more about that, if you want to learn about this in more than this just very racing glimpse, you can take that course, and this will be undoubtedly they will recover this material at a slower pace. For the rest of you, I just wanted to get across the flavor that you get these predictions for things that you can observe today in terms of simple expressions that depend on the values of cosmological quantities, like this thing, which had to do with the shape of the inflaton potential and the rate of the Hubble of the rate of expansion of the universe at the ultra early moment when this, remember we said this mode has two important moments in its life. First, when it crosses outside the horizon, and second, when it crosses inside the horizon. And you today are measuring things about the universe at that early moment when it crossed outside the horizon. So if inflation is right, these things that we're measuring today are by far probably the best observations of ultra high energy physics that we will ever get. And so you get this thing for many values of k. So you measure this as sort of as a function of time, as different modes exit the horizon at different times. So you don't just get it for 1k, you get it for all the different wavelengths that you can measure today, but different co-moving wavelengths. The longest one exited first, the next one exited next, the next one exited next. So you're measuring the behavior of the early universe as a function of time, measuring the shape of the inflaton potential via phi. And as I said, the one final thing I want to get across is that the simplest potential you can think of, so one scalar field and one, if the scalar field is just a free massive scalar field, that potential, if you work it through, its predictions for the scalar perturbations as a function of wavelength, and for the tensor perturbations, which have not yet been observed, are in perfect agreement with current observations. So the model only has this one extra degree of freedom, and only a single free parameter, but it correctly reproduces. It correctly predicts. Wide swath of very detailed things that we have already observed about the universe. And so it is the, as I was saying, we don't know that this model is right, but the other thing you should go away from this course knowing is that there is this one explanation of the early universe that is genuinely doing a good job at the moment, and that is sort of the gold standard according to which all other purported explanations of the early universe should be judged. They may involve fancy ingredients, but do they manage to explain everything with one parameter? You should ask yourself. Okay, so that's all I have time for. Thank you very much. I loved it. If you have any feedback about the notes, I'm hoping to make the notes better and to not flub some of the things I flubbed this year when I teach the course next year. So any things that are wrong with the notes or any comments about how the class was organized or what things were confusing would be most, either anonymous or not anonymous, would be most appreciated. Okay, yeah, that's it. Oh, you guys.